I doubt seriously that many of you know that the idea banks that run most of this country, Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, was the birth child of Milner with his kindergartens and Cecil Rhodes Roundtable, conceived and thought out in what was Rhodesia and South Africa. And I'm back to tragedy and hope again tonight, which will shed some light on South Africa. And during today and tomorrow and these very crucial days before the Senate passes its vote, I'm still here saying, I don't know enough, and I know more than most of the people I've been listening to talk on the subject. But I don't know enough to know what the proper action should be in South Africa at this moment. I'm sure our senators don't. And there's been enough pressure put on South Africa that if they're going to respond to sanctions, they'll respond to the pressure that's already put on. So let's don't kill the chance for the response to take. Let's don't force a bringing down of Botha's government by the hardliners who say, I told you so, what you did didn't work, it never caused anybody to back off, we're left alone on this far-end corner of the world, and we got to fight for our survival. And a bloodbath will be engendered on the white side, and likewise the sane voices on the black side need to have an outlet to be heard. There are plenty of black leaders that don't want the sanctions and say it's not going to help the black people at all. All I'm saying, it's time we lift this thing above a race discussion to the reality of what is in South Africa. And I have a network that's capable of airing the issue anytime during a 24-hour period, each and every day. So I'm here for the next few days doing what I usually do, but in addition saying, can I marshal the thinking people who listen to me to simply call your senators and say, give us some time. If they don't listen to us, we'll be able to say we stood in the gap at this time, and I told you so when the bloodbath comes. Clear enough? I want you on the phone, if you're glad I'm still here. Some of you prayed for my safety, I'm still safe. Get on the phone and call me, and let's take a few minutes to get your reactions. You that have called your senators, tell me. You that are going to call your senators. Letters won't get there in time. The voting is going to start Monday. You've got to put the pressure on tomorrow. That's why I'm here tonight. I have several calls here I want to refer to. Here's one. I've been following Doc Scott's ministry, this from New York City, with some interest, having spent 12 years in South Africa. I've been put in prison for 6 months for giving communion to a black child. I'm a white priest. It is, in my opinion, solely an issue of race. So you don't think that I'm naive. I have been reading, probably my fourth reading of it, as I absorb it so I can talk about it without having to turn to the pages, Freedom Rising, Life Under Apartheid Through the Eyes of an American on a 4-year clandestine journey through Southern Africa. Very unsympathetic. All I'm saying is that on the surface, the Civil War was solely an issue of race. Not that simple. There are lots of people who fought for the emancipation not because they loved the blacks. They had economic reasons. There were some other larger purposes, like saving the Union. There were people who fought and took their positions who were not as philosophically firm as they should have been on slavery and on the race issue. Remember, the inerrant word of God people still have to deal with Philemon, where Paul's answer to slavery was, don't rock the boat. And there were people in the South that had mixed motives. The surface issue condemned the deeper problems that must be brought into consideration than solution. I am convinced that there is racial prejudice and racial mistreatment and apartheid is a rationale for that which is nothing but racial bigotry in South Africa as it exists in every country. The truck drivers that will argue that the blacks simply can't be trained, don't have the brains to drive trucks, and all the time they'll be waving at somebody on the other side of the road that's driving one with equal efficiency. I'm not saying there's no race problem in South America, South Africa. I'm saying that the solution has to rise above that. And prejudice is wrong in any realm. And an embryo grows into a full-blown evil. The women don't have it too good either in South Africa when compared to liberated America, and yet liberated America is not where the ERA would like to take them. And that's why so many of your white liberals in South Africa are ladies. I'm simply saying the solution has to be lifted above that black man beating on a white man beating on a black man level. The facts of the complications of South Africa and deep-seated generations of rationales. As Niebuhr said, the Jews were gassed by Germans. I've read E.G. Farben, The Crime and Punishment of E.G. Farben, the basis of the movie The Formula. Nobel Prize winners solve their conscience sufficient they could have a champagne party when they reach their quotas in the plant. Said quotas being brought out of the blood and guts and death and suffering of the Jewish prisoners that ran in the snow to the plant to work every day. I know there's race problems there, but the solution has to rise above race problems and recognize that there is something worse, and that's a holocaust of a bloodbath. And that's my plea for time. Arcadia, why are you taking such a strong stand on a political issue? I'm not. I'm taking a strong stand on a human life issue. It's a political issue, I'm not interested. But I feel that somebody, since a couple of ministers have gotten up there calling each other reverend and allowed themselves to be postured into making an issue that demands statesmanship look like a square off between blacks and whites, if that can be avoided at all costs, it should be avoided. I'm on a human life issue right here. Common sense and intelligence, I teach. This subject is a historical fruit of some bad mistakes that can't be cured by yelling and racial posturing. That's my position. Dixon, Tennessee. I want to ask Doc if he's read James Michener's novel about South Africa, The Covenant. Yes, James Michener is a college history professor at Hart. He just uses novels to do it. And his research is generally very solid. And it wouldn't hurt anyone to read The Covenant. You'll get a fictional entertainment job, but you will get a pretty basic grip on the history of South Africa from that first little man making his trek across the desert in prehistoric times to the last chapter, which is a very interesting and generally accurate summary. So the answer is yes. Dallas, Texas. I'm an engineer for Texas Instruments. The country of South Africa is the only source of chromium, which is used in the building of jet engines. No chromium, no jet engines. The leftists are using this to further their causes. Now, see, that's one point of view. There's a lot of people think that the Civil War was strictly a moral battle by people wanting to free the slaves and those who didn't. Well, that was, thank God, a part of it. But that wasn't the only issue. People had those moral convictions a long time before economic and state pride issues pushed it over the brink. Tiburon, Doc, you give the appearance of being more concerned with saving of white lives than black because already the white government has used too much violence and blood shed to maintain its position. No, I don't. I don't give that appearance. You don't listen at all. I don't give that appearance. I'm not passing judgment on anything that's now happening. I'm passing judgment on what will happen. Bloodshed on both sides. And number two, you don't know for sure that what you're seeing in the news media is a fair and balanced presentation. I only want to avoid a future revolution like Zimbabwe if change can occur without it, which leads me to the next disagreement. Markham, Illinois. I'd like to register a no on what you're saying. The South African government has had 300 years to change and haven't. Yes, they have. They never in at least 275 of those years ever admitted they had to change. They never in at least 275 of those years gave any indication of wanting to change. I have said repeatedly, I've approved the sanctions thus far, but if they had a purpose, then the purpose should have been to get a result. Now we've tried it. Back off and see if any results occur. If it doesn't, then it's a fruitless endeavor anyway. Listen to me. What you're doing is reacting emotionally and engaging in a debate on the issues, when all I'm saying is, I haven't had 300 years to think about this, and neither have you. You're just regurgitating to me some speech somebody gave you. I want the time for intelligent people to look at this. And I'm going to hang in there. I mean, you know, a Missouri mule that won't work, or an old army mule, suddenly has a little different working attitude when he's hit between the eyes with a 2x4. I'm not opposing past sanctions. I'm opposing a broadside national sanction now added to the private sanctions when we haven't had the time to see if the private sanctions produce any results. I believe if you're going to whip a kid, you should back off and see if the discipline does any good. Don't kill him. I can't stand people who react to me as though they've been listening to somebody else. React to me for what I say. Don't give me the same kind of stupid, polarized remark that belongs to somebody else. I haven't taken sides yet. And I got the opportunity to go in without any coercion and give the full pictures. Assume I confirm everything that everybody has radically said. Fine. I just want the peace of mind to do it, and I deal with my people this way, and I'm not willing to have some litany of old-fashioned cliches beat on me. I mean, the world had some 2,000 years doing nothing about slavery till the Civil War. Time to start.
I don't think I would win a popularity contest in South Africa with the blacks or the whites. I just believe that heroes are made by the occasion, and you do what you have to do.
I believe that Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King rose to the challenge to do a right thing a right way. They suffered criticism, but history's proved them right. Now, South Africa calls for statesmanship, and everything that puts fuel in the fire of emotion is trouble. And human nature is the same whether you're black or white. You hold a gun to people's head long enough, they're going to say, you pull that damn trigger, and you better hope you've killed me. Now, in the view of some of the blacks, the whites have held the gun at the head too long. But now the whole world. And when you have statesmanship, you back off and look at things in the larger sphere. I don't really care whether Botta, the radicals, or the blacks to prove what I'm saying. I'm on a crusade for truth and the rule of sanity. Now, the blacks have been oppressed, and the Indians have been oppressed, and the liberals have been oppressed, whatever their color, because those Dutch Christians epitomize what I call the wrong expression of legalistic Christianity. So sinners have been oppressed, whether they're black or white. And I'm on a crusade to say to sinners, God loves you and grace and peace. I'm a preacher like Jesus. I can claim one thing that I'm like him, who's a friend of sinners. Now, you hold a gun long enough, people are going to say, you shoot. But if we can get to you, we're going to choke you while we're dying. That's human nature. God made us free, and you can't bottle people up too long. That's why I like the title of this book, Freedom Rising. But when the whole world then self-righteously puts the gun at the head of the oppressor too much, he's going to react too. Now the whole world says we're not going to stand for this. They got their rationales. They see they've been singled out for stones to be cast at them, like the woman taken in adultery, caught in the very act of sin. But Jesus said, he that's without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. And they backed off, and Jesus then said to her, go and sin no more. Give the woman and the state the chance. The issue I'm on is we're pushing it too far. Are we on just a bloodbath, catharsis, vengeance trip? Oh, I hear the speeches, drive them to the conference table. Well, they ain't going to go. There are some whites would rather fight than switch. But there are lots of whites that want to switch and don't want to fight. But they got to be given a chance now. Now, I'm arguing for sanity, that's all. If the sanctions had a purpose, give the purpose a chance to demonstrate whether it can be achieved. And if it can't, why just force more sanctions to prove we can sanction? Was it a purposeless endeavor or a show-offy vengeance? I ain't going to be bulldozed by anybody. Chicago, Illinois, we have a Boeing 727 that you can use for any special project you wish. Gives me his name, the company he's a director of, says your teaching has captured the minds and spirits of our board of directors. We give substantial sums corporately to religious organizations every year. And I'm going to call, he names the person at Channel 26 and Chicago to congratulate him for carrying you. We watch every night. Isn't that nice? And I'm grateful and do appreciate it. I can tell you I've long since graduated from the joy of traveling to make a trip, and I want to be able to do it effectively. This is a marvelous and wonderful gesture, and I want Craig Lamp to call and find the specifics for how we go about it, because I want to take you up on that offer. I want to talk to you now. I want to talk now. My turn. I want to talk to you. You know, we think that everybody is born coming out of the womb thinking just the way we think on every subject. You know, that's a basic human weakness, to judge everybody by ourselves. South Africans should think just like us. And if they don't know something's wrong, they're just covering their sins, and they ought to be beat into submission. There are some Southern Baptist preachers listening to me right now in the South that could wish they had not preached some of their crazy doctrines about race in their past history. Reinhold Niebuhr said years ago, you ought to be careful about prematurely taking too hard a stand on things when you're young as a preacher. You may spend the rest of your life having to explain why you didn't mean what you said. Now, I want you to get off the telephone. It's my turn to talk. Answer the phones over at King's House 1. Let's see if we can't start learning something about South Africa, where it got its ideas. How many of you know that one single organization, more than any other, has contributed to the leadership of America, particularly in international affairs? And that's the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, I do not believe what some extremists believe, that that's a cadre of conspirators who live with a passion to rule the world. I believe that the core of that group is an attitude that permeated the educational mind of our nation for many years, that the educated have a responsibility to steer this world a bit. It's elitism. But they have a respect for brain power and certain methods of research, and when they find a budding brain, they reach out and grab it, and they've been able to create an establishment in this, prestigious. You want to be a part of the group because of the perks of intellectual recognition and associations in the community, and they've been able to put together a core group of thinkers that have a one-world viewpoint, recognize interdependence among countries, and truly and honestly believe that they're serving their generation with the best of their ability and the best of their gifts. They didn't originate that idea. Council on Foreign Relations is a product of the round tables that were set up in this country originating in the British Empire. And where do you think the ideas came from? You interested? This is the background. Now, you can't understand South Africa until you start realizing that even though they've moved it to a point of rationalizing relationships between the races that they want to perpetuate, there are 10 tribes there. It's not just whites against blacks. The chieftain of the Zulus, and the Zulus does not feel on this subject the same way the residents of Soweto feel, and not all the residents of Soweto feel the same way. There is not a homogenized black viewpoint. There is not a kind of uniform frame of reference of all ex-slaves striving for the rights earned in blood and death and the Civil War to be expressed in the daily life of America. South Africa is not America. They weren't transplanted, pulled somewhere, made slaves, and have a common cultural background. Seems stupid to have to say that, doesn't it? And you're not going to find the Zulu tribe looking at things the same way that the denizens of Soweto do, which is the spatial township and settled area for the blacks and the coloreds that achieved fame in 76 when their riots burst loose. You're not going to find as much homogeneity among the whites. I mean, we have Italian Americans. I looked at an ad today of a Greek American that said, my father taught me to be both Greek and American. You don't have that dream and pride at becoming American that was part of the unifying force in the United States with all of its pluralism and diversity of races. There are Afrikaners that would much rather shoot an Englishman than a black man. And they have a great deal more reason to hate an Englishman than a black man or a colored man. And there are some Englishmen that will tell you in South Africa that all the problems of South Africa are the Afrikaners, the Dutch, that lost the Boer War but feel they should have won it and still feel that God gave them divinely this South African nation. Don't oversimplify. Now, these rationales for the ideas that are at work in today's world have deep and abiding roots. Let me give you some of it. Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by Carol Quigley. Who's Carol Quigley? Good for leather coats. He was a member of that elite group who broke the secrecy, and his book is full of indications that it's about time the world find out that it owes a debt to brainy, dedicated men who have given their life to steer in this world the direction it ought to go. He's not some conspirator. He's a professor at some of the most prestigious universities in America who finally decided that it's about time a little credit be given to the men that this world owes some debt to. The landed upper class of England was a unique development. A landed oligarchy developed that was different from Europe, unique to England. It created an aristocracy that could never be nobles, because nobility was based upon blood and genealogy. But the landed landowners developed an aristocracy in England. The nobility could not stoop to involve itself in business on the continent. These landed aristocrats of England controlled the business, and controlled the army, and really took over the country. They were the nouveau riche. But they still lived with the concept of primogeniture. The firstborn son inherited all the estate. The rest of the kids were trained and full of vinegar, and they had to find an outlet for what they did. They all got the same training, but only one son could take over the family business. Now, I've taught on the Lost Tribes about the sons and the vines that go over the wall. Now, there was a conflict in the thinking of England as colonialism spread abroad around the world. And there was a group grew up in the English frame of reference called the Little Englanders. They felt, led by Gladstone, I'm going to start reading. They felt that it was a source of great expense. They were convinced. This is in the 1800s. They were convinced that the colonies involved England in remote strategic problems which could easily lead to wars England had no need to fight. They could see no economic advantage in having an empire, since the existence of free trade, which this generation has accepted, would allow commerce to flow no matter who held the territories. And they were convinced. Here's Gladstone is Little Englanders. They were convinced that any colonial area, no matter at what cost they might be acquired, would eventually separate from the mother country. Voluntarily, if they were given the rights of Englishmen, or by rebellion, as the American colonies had done, if they were deprived of such rights. In general, the Little Englanders, as they were called, were averse to colonial expansion on the grounds of cost. Although upholders of the Little England point of view, men like Gladstone or Sir William Harcourt, continued in political prominence until 1895. Then that view went into steady retreat after 1870. They were opposed. This is the way thought processes develop in a nation. We right now have the conservatives in the White House in America, and the thinking of leadership in America, though it's wonderful to quote him in times of election, Ronald Reagan's a far cry from FDR, which is why I'm enjoying doing a play on FDR right now. What caused the Little Englander viewpoint to diminish? In the Liberal Party, the Little Englanders were opposed by imperialists like Lord Rosebery, even before 1895. After that date, a younger group of imperialists like... Not very many people would start reading from a history book this dry at midnight, which ought to tell you how I feel about my people. You say, when are you going to get to South Africa? You watch. Imperialists like Lord Rosebery. After that date, a younger group of imperialists, Asquith, Gray, and Haldane, took over the party. In the Conservative Party, where the anti-imperialist idea had never been strong, modern imperialists like Lord Salisbury were followed by more active imperialists like Joseph Chamberlain or Lords Curzon, Selborne, and Milner. There were many factors which led to the growth of imperialism after 1870. An interesting date to you who listen to me teach, by the way. And many obvious manifestations of that growth. The Royal Colonial Institute was founded in 1868 to fight the Little England idea. Disraeli, as Prime Minister until 1880, dramatized the profit and glamour of empire by such acts as the purchase of control of the Suez Canal and by granting Queen Victoria the title of Empress of India. After 1870, it became increasingly evident that however expensive colonies might be to a government, they could be fantastically profitable to individuals. Now we're going to start getting down to some matters that may have to do with more than color. Fantastically profitable to individuals and companies supported by such governments. Moreover, with the spread of democracy and the growing influence of the press and the expanding need for campaign contributions, individuals who made fantastic profits in overseas adventures could obtain favorable support from their own governments by contributing some part of their profits to the politicians' expenses. 1870. You suppose that kind of thing still goes on? Among other things, notice the efforts of King Leopold II of Belgium using Henry Stanley, of all men, to obtain the Congo area as his own private preserve in 1876 to 1880. This started a contagious fever of colony grabbing in Africa, which lasted for more than 30 years. Now, if you want to read Michener in his history of the rise of the Zulu kingdom, where that hard head that was rejected by a black tribe that he tried to assimilate with decided to put together the greatest fighting machine that ever lived. He got young men, put them through discipline, made them run barefooted over briars and rocks until their feet were as calloused as the hooves of deer in appearance. He taught them to fight in new manners. He was the Alexander the Great of Africa, Central Africa, and Southern Africa. And he had enforcers, big, brawny, knobby-armed guys that if one guy, they didn't get a second chance. If one guy got out of line, these guys would grab them and bang their heads, and bust their skulls to make an example out of them in front of everybody. Not the epitome of grace and peace. I mean, you know, human nature is human nature, and all I'm appealing for is a recognition, as the neo-Orthodox people did, that man's got a problem with sin. Sin, in essence, we seek our own way at the expense of others and God. And color doesn't change it, it just disguises it. And the ends like to stay in, and the outs want to get in. Many ends want them to stay out. Now, when you get an in willing to make room for the out, give him a chance, because the out's eventually going to force his way in if they don't give him a chance. Now, there's no sense complicating simple things. It's just an in and out situation. Fever of colony grabbing in Africa, which lasted for more than 30 years. The discovery of diamonds. Well, now, I thought that the problem in South Africa was fighting over diamonds since 1652. Diamonds were discovered in 1869. You mean since the Civil War in America? Well, they sure discovered gold, because everybody knows the gold rush was in the 1840s. They discovered it in Africa in 1886. If you're 99 years old, you got something to remember your birth date over. And with the discovery of diamonds in 1869 and gold in 1886 in South Africa, especially in the Boer Transvaal Republic, this fever for colony grabbing in Africa was intensified. Now, I don't judge him for it, but a successful black lawyer in fact, our mayor didn't buy his home down in Watts. And a successful black lawyer or surgeon is not going to find it easy to turn his income and what he's worked hard for, especially hard because of some handicaps he's faced in an unfair society. He's not going to be so eager to turn it over to his black brothers of lesser means. They're not new to the race. It's just the ends want to stay in, keep the outers out. I'm reading from Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley, the roots of some of the problems in South Africa. Prior to the 1870s, the Little Englanders, led by Gladstone and his successors, opposed any colonial activity at all. But England had a problem. The nouveau riche, the landed aristocracy, trained all of their young men in the tough boys' schools like Eton and others. Unlike the nobility of Europe that didn't involve themselves in war and in business and had their position because of bloodline genealogy claims, the landed aristocracy of England produced riches, training, but still sticking to primogeniture in inheritance. The oldest son got the whole family estate, and all these energized young men trained to go out and get the job done had no place to go. Colonialism sprang out of that. The Little Englanders said it's a problem, it's too expensive, the gains are not worth the effort, and no matter what we do, particularly heightened with the revolution in America, every colony eventually will break free, so it's wasted effort. But as Africa began to open, people began to discover that even though the government might not gain from imperialistic colonial activities, individuals and companies could. And when the discovery of diamonds in 1869 and gold in 1886 turned the spotlight on Africa, imperialism took off. Now, no man can persist in any activity very long without proving to himself it's right. We had that problem in America with the robber barons. They had to come up with a religious philosophy that God had picked them. They were predestined to have it because they would use it better than the people that didn't have it. And the great philanthropic activities began to explode as a proof that they deserved to have the money because they knew how to use it. Likewise, with imperialism, the changes that occurred in England were different than the rationales that had preceded. The chief changes, imperialism began to be justified on grounds of moral duty. Social reform. How many times you heard in America people in the South say, we love the blacks as individuals. The Northerners love them as a group. But we love them. We love our mommies, our mammies. We take care of them when they're sick. That patronage, paternal viewpoint. They're part of our family who know their place. And the Northerners don't really like them as individuals. I've heard that. I'm telling you, we didn't solve our problems in 1 year. And sanctions produce revolution. We all know that. We're a product. You say, well, our revolution proves the rightness of them. Tell that to the ones that died. I mean, we're just lucky. We're here after the fact. Moral duty and social reform became the argument justifying the colonies, not missionary activity and material advantage. One man was responsible for this change. I'm telling you, the power of a teacher, you're going to see in a moment. Until 1870, there was no professorship of fine arts at Oxford, but in that year, thanks to the Slade bequest, now you may find it hard to believe that in America we're facing the consequences of the Trilateral Commission and a deliberate decision that the United States can no longer stand alone and must somehow link itself into a triad with Europe and Japan for survival, and it must give up certain nationalistic interests for the longer range hauls. You find it very hard to believe that this country, every Secretary of State except a bare number that can be counted on one hand, has come out of the thinking of the mother of the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, which in turn was the child of the Round Table Societies, which in turn was the child of Cecil Rhodes and Milner's work, which in turn was the child of this man we're going to meet right now, John Ruskin. There was no professorship of fine arts at Oxford. But in that year, thanks to the Slade bequest, John Ruskin was named to such a chair. Professor of Fine Arts at Oxford. He hit Oxford like an earthquake. Not so much because he talked about fine arts. Give me just a little more mic. But because he talked also about the empire. See, most people who teach never make any application to anything. You just learn it because they say learn it. Now you got me too loud. John Ruskin didn't just talk about fine arts, and they must have fixed the air conditioning because it's getting cold, too cold. He hit Oxford like an earthquake, not so much because he talked about fine arts, but because he made it come alive. He talked also about the empire and England's downtrodden masses. And above all, because he talked about all three of these things, his moral issues. Until the end of the 19th century, the poverty-stricken masses in the cities of England lived in want, ignorance, and crime, very much as they had been described by Charles Dickens. Ruskin spoke to the Oxford undergraduates as members of the privileged ruling class. He told them that they were the possessors of a magnificent tradition of education, beauty, rule of law, freedom, decency, and self-discipline, but that this tradition could not be saved and did not deserve to be saved unless it could be extended to the lower classes in England itself and to the non-English masses throughout the world. If this precious tradition were not extended to these two great majorities, the lower classes in England and the non-English-speaking masses throughout the world, if this precious tradition were not extended to these two great majorities, the minority of upper-class Englishmen would ultimately be submerged by these majorities and the tradition lost.
This is the end of side one. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for side two. Thank you.